It's another Friday night at the Howling Dog Saloon, a two-room roadhouse that sits just off the Steese Highway, about 10 miles north of Fairbanks, in a small town called Fox. The wooden floor here runs the length of a 40-foot bar, also wood, through a doorway, past wooden spool tables, out onto a dance floor. It seems just about everyone who's been through here in the past 10 years left something behind. Flags of a half-dozen nations hang from the rafters, burned-out neon beer signs that have long since lost their commercial appeal. On the far wall, a plywood panel boasts the Howling Dog's advertising slogan, "Yo, baby." Covering the bandstand is perhaps the Howling Dog's biggest claim to fame. It's a red carpet that was once tread upon by President Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II when they visited Fairbanks 3 years ago. If this setting sounds a bit confused, then the clientele can only be seen as a compliment. Patrons here span the breadth of the Fairbanks social strata, including bar owner Mike Brock, who's been sitting at one end of this bar, off and on, for 10 years now.
Yeah, this is pretty much my grandstand seat has been for the last 10 years. And I think that the Howling Dog is probably the only place in existence that's totally beyond the caste system. That if you look up and down the bar here right now, you'll see college professors, doctors, lawyers, and guys that haven't worked in 10 years sitting there drinking together. And bikers and mean-looking people next to them. I've even seen a couple of North Pole preachers slide out here and win the slide.
But what brings this diverse crowd out is as much the company as it is the live music, supplied by a rhythm and blues quartet better known as the Flyers.
You broke my heart. Cause I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. But now I'm back. To let you know, I can really shake them down. Do you love me?
The Flyers have been together in one form or another through most of the 1980s, playing the crowd-pleasing classics from Chuck Berry to Elvis Costello. They've been around long enough for most of the crowd to know each by name, and most of their fans think of the Flyers as one of their own.
They're the only reason I came out tonight, though, was to hear these guys, oh yeah.
It's the Flyers groupie.
I'm their best groupie. Yeah, I've known them for about 10 years. I've been dancing at the Dog for about 15.
Why do you think so many people follow this band?
Ooh, because they're great. And they really neat people, and they be friends to people. You know, they take time for people and care about them.
Band mostly, because I think they're a great rock and roll band.
While they enjoy the classics, the fans here are just as wild about the Flyers' original tunes, most of them written by the band's nucleus of Pat Fitzgerald and Robin Dale Ford. Together for more than a decade, Fitzgerald and Ford have seen a lot of the Alaska bandstand circuit, from Homer to Fairbanks. They even settled for a few years in Anchorage. They see the Flyers' original tunes as an alternative to the all-too-common top 40 acts.
It's a song by Pat Fitzgerald.
But the recent economic slide in Alaska has put the squeeze on original music. As Ford and Fitzgerald explain, it's what forced them out of Anchorage and back to their hometown of Fairbanks.
As soon as the economy got bad in Anchorage, it seemed, just a couple years ago, and the pipeline, you know, wound down, and they started tightening their belts, and the bar managers started saying, well, we can't take a chance.
That's it, exactly. When we stay in Fairbanks, we can pretty much do whatever we want. People are real supportive, and they know us. It's trying to go anywhere else in Alaska with our playlist that it's almost impossible to find work.
It's in this sense that everyone gets what they want at the Howling Dog. The band gets support for their original work. The crowd gets a chance to hear something new. Unless the market for original work changes, Ford and Fitzgerald say the Howling Dog is enough for now. It's brought them enough money to live modestly and pursue their careers in other ways. Robin Dale Ford produced her own record last year, entitled State of Grace, and Fitzgerald has made a few demonstration tapes. With them, they both hope to attract agents and to eventually catch the eye of some record company executive. But there doesn't seem to be much of a hurry.
I have a young brother that plays drums in Los Angeles. He's been doing that for 5 years, trying in bands to play original music and trying to do that. And I visited him there, and it's not a pretty sight. It really isn't. The way we're figuring out, there's no use to go down and live somewhere, you know, in the Los Angeles area, when we can live up here and commute. Yeah.
The Howling Dog is closed now, shut down until spring. Drummer John Carnahan and lead guitarist Curtis Cunningham probably won't be back next year. But turnover is a common occurrence in the rock and roll business. Patrick Fitzgerald and Robindale Ford figure the Flyers will be back come spring, in another form. And there's a better than even chance their fans will be waiting for them, probably at the Howling Dog.
To me, it's the heart of rock and roll still beats at the Howling Dog Saloon, and it's hard to find that kind of situation.
With help from Phil Falkowski, this is Barnaby Dow in Fairbanks. Songs by Curtis Cunningham, Patrick Fitzgerald, and Robindale Ford. If you haven't ever seen a muskox, they're a little difficult to describe. These 750-pound animals look like a cross between their distant cousin, the water buffalo, and the North American buffalo. The males stand about as tall as a compact car, with a thick mat of guard hairs that hang down like a stringy black curtain around their bulky frames. Long horns curl out from above their brows. Research biologists Christine Scandunas and Bill Hauer are trying to coax Brown, a 450-pound cow, and her newborn calf into the barn for milking. But Hauer says the can of dried food being offered isn't having much of an effect.
Brown isn't quite as easy to lure in with a grain can because she's on the high plane of nutrition, and so she's not quite as hungry for this grain as Red is.
The muskox have names that correspond to the patch of fluorescent paint sprayed on their backs. These cows are part of an ongoing study of muskox that began in 1979, when the first colony was transplanted from Nunavak Island off the western coast of Alaska. This research has become increasingly important to biologists, ecologists, and politicians as the development issues heat up on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A herd of muskox roams the coastal plain today. And while Caribou may be stealing the limelight of controversy, development's impact on the muskox is a major concern for biologists. Robert White is professor of zoo physiology at the University of Alaska and head of the Large Animal Research Station.
If you knew the number of animals that, I mean, number of species that are going extinct annually, it's kind of terrifying. And, of course, all of these fundamental principles that we're interested in have mechanisms that are there, allow us these things to happen. And it's understanding the mechanisms, which are, as far as I'm concerned, the mechanisms are encoded on the genome of the animals, and that's our job, is to unravel that encoding and find out how it's translated to the advantage each one has in its various habitats.
One of those ways of finding out is through analyzing the cow's milk. By now, White's assistants have given up on verbal coaxing and instead try another tack, this time carrying Brown's calf into the milking barn. It's a move that settles the issue, but has Brown now closed off in a chute and in a mood to offer her protest. Once at her milking station, Brown shows her affections by knocking over a plastic bucket of food she's been offered. Milking a muskox is just as easy as milking a cow, and only a half a cup is needed for testing. As Hauer explains, Brown has been drinking water that contains an isotope called a marker that enables the biologist to track milk production.
And as the calf nurses, we look for the appearance of this marker in the calf. When we take our urine sample from the calf, we see a gradual increase in this marker. Well, the only way that that can be is that he's getting it through the milk. And knowing the rate of increase, we can know how much milk the calf is drinking, how much milk the cow is producing.
Milk production is just one piece of the ongoing study on muskox. There are hundreds of other facets for determining what actually happens out in the wild, including hundreds of hours of just plain watching and taking notes. Professor White says, unlike the hotly debated behaviors of the caribou, muskox don't migrate, but that in itself presents some serious considerations for managing herds, should oil exploration be permitted in the refuge. His studies indicate the fall rut is one of the most critical times of year for muskox cows, who must put on tremendous body weight in order to make it through the winter, a time when disturbances should be kept to a minimum.
For instance, we should say that no, you cannot fly in and do research in these areas where there are muskox during the rut. Secondarily, we should find out how much of this kind of late summer fall habitat is available in the areas of the National Wildlife Refuge, and make sure that if there is only a little bit of it, then it's put off out of bounds for any kind of activities that's likely to change the condition of that range and that habitat.
The muskox no longer faces extinction, as it did decades ago when hunting drove the herds back to the fringes of northern Canada and Greenland. White says there are more muskox today than ever before, but he says much is still unknown about how changes will affect the habits of this creature that ekes out an existence on the edges of the world's harshest environment. But with the development of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge hanging in the balance, the push is on to find out.
With the large changes in climate that could occur in the north, with the global warming that's occurring, and who knows, in 100 years' time, there may well be very few niches available that will allow for the long-term survival of muskox. Of course, society will make the decision, not us. We're just here to try and open everyone's eyes to what we think is happening with these natural situations.
Congressionally ordered studies on the behavior of muskox and other northern animals begin next month on the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Barnaby Dow. It's 9 o'clock on a bright Sunday morning as conductor George Ash hops on the 2809 for the first run of the summer season. Two locomotives, three coaches, a baggage car, and 98 passengers.
Passenger 2809 to the Anchorage Yardmaster.
Here.
Good morning, Leon. You can throw this train out of town on time, if you will, please.
On time. Roger that. Have a good trip, George.
Okay, thank you. Have a nice day.
For 36 years, Ash has been working trains, 20 of those with the Alaska Railroad. He's ridden more than 1.5 miles of track. Ash has seen the magnificent landscape along this route more than 1,000 times. And after 2 decades, he still remembers to bring his camera.
I like to have a camera because you don't know what's going to happen. And a picture is better than 1,000 words, you know.
As the 2809 chugs through the sparse and greening countryside, Ash remembers a time when the railroad was the sole lifeline to the interior, especially to the hundreds of homesteads strung along its route.
We used to have a freight train that handled all kind of way freight, as we called it, and I've done lots of that. Unload 50 or 75, 100-pound bags of dog food, you know, and 55-gallon drums of gasoline and diesel fuel and 50-pound bottles of propane gas and everything that people need out here, you know.
The summer passenger runs don't haul freight now, but crewmen still find time to toss out the Sunday paper to a few dozen homesteads along the way. No charge, just a favor.
Thank you very much.
You've got mine.
And you're going to Fairbanks.
Right.
All right. Your face is very familiar, but I guess you've heard that before. Do
no,
I know you?
It's familiar.
As he works his way through the coaches, punching tickets, Ash gets an earful from the travelers. Just about everyone has a story to tell, and a lot of it is nostalgia about trains. Since this is the first run of the year, riders are an even mix of sightseers and interior residents on their way back home. One young man holds up an animal tusk for inspection by an intrigued passenger.
You say it's from a warthog?
Yes, it's the tusk that grows out of the wild pig
here
of Africa.
Here in Alaska?
No, ma'am. No, that's what you didn't know. I'm just returning from 2 years in Africa, and this is some of my stuff that I picked
up that you got in
when,
Africa.
When I was traveling.
Oh,
I see.
Mike Speaks is a river guide, headed back to his home in Denali Park after 2 years overseas. His train memories reach back only a few months. Though for him, his trip through Central Africa was something like a walk back in time.
Yeah, I'm a train buff, sort of. One of the best that comes to mind is the Tazara train station, that train line that runs from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to Lusaka, Zambia, which was the train I traveled. And it's your classic third world situation where you're crossing countries and you're having borders, which mean the customs and the immigration people are coming in and going through all your gear and trying to find something and trying to force you into bribing them so that they're not going to cause you any hassles. And then, you know, on any of those kind of trains, there is no food. There's no water to drink. There's basically what you have. There's no blankets for the sleeper cars. If you don't have the things that you want to be comfortable, then you're not going to be comfortable. Not to mention it's hotter than Hades.
The last train I was on, the, 48 was the last time.
Doris Bradley is on her way to Denali Park to take in the sights. The former school teacher from upstate New York remembers a less comfortable time on the rails.
We had 20 in the senior class and took them to Washington, D.C., and then up to New York City and then back during Easter vacation. And the seats were not like this, and it was not as comfortable, so this is really much better. It's a little hazy, though, to tell you the truth.
Between cars now, where 45-year-old Dave Liddell leans out the doorway for a camera shot of a swamp dotted with beaver dams.
I'm not really a train buff, but I know a fun train when I see one, you know?
Liddell is from Los Angeles, and this train reminds him of his youth, when he used to take the electric trolley from outside his home in Long Beach and ride it into the city. Slower times that he likely won't see again in L.A.
You know, it's just from a different era almost, being up here. It's a friendlier time. It's a more, affable, I guess is the way I'd put it. It's still real nice. It's not what you'd call express in the express sense of the word. I mean, it's, we're not going through this place. It's not the Zephyr, you know, but still, who cares? It's real pleasant. It makes it all the nicer for what it is, you know?
Back in the rear coach, conductor George Ash has finished up with his tickets and waits for the 2809 to pull into Denali Park. That's where he'll change with the southbound train that'll take him back home. It's been an uneventful trip, one he probably won't pause to think about in the future. But scenery and conversation isn't the only thing that keeps him on the railroad.
Huh. It's hard to explain. It's like somebody once said old habits are hard to break, you know. I worked for the railroads for many years, and I guess I enjoyed the work. And so even though oftentimes the work was tough, it didn't seem so bad because I enjoyed what I was doing, you know.
The Alaska Railroad summer season runs through mid-August. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Barnaby Dow.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus.
Do you dread the holidays that are coming too soon?
Sometimes we do too, so we're rapping this tune.
Every year about this time, do you feel a little blue?
Because your people ain't here, and you don't know what to do?
It is the season when you should be feeling jolly.
Instead, you're down and out, just a little melancholy.
Thanksgiving Day, what does it really mean?
People stuffing themselves, it's not a pretty scene.
Eating turkey, taters, and mincemeat pie.
Have three or four helpings, eat it till you die.
Everyone's so busy scarfing down the food.
Thanking no one for nothing, it seems a little crude.
Next comes Christmas. Forget about the birth.
Or the baby in the manger. Because what is that worth?
We're talking big bucks, and that story don't sell.
You need a Cuisinart, your wife will like it real well.
I want a Ken, Barbie, and a video game.
Who's marrying Joseph, and what's his name?
The first of the year is a very special time.
When we all get bombed out of our collective minds.
I'm going to a party drink all night long.
What do you mean, can I drive? What's the matter? What's wrong?
I quit cigs, booze, as a resolution.
Sure am glad no one heard in this confusion.
I don't mean to be a Scrooge, and I sure don't want to preach.
But what kind of lesson is the season supposed to teach?
You want peace, goodwill, and joy among men?
Okay, all right. What should I do then?
When Thanksgiving rolls around and you're feeding your face,
think about those people in some faraway place.
Where the rain didn't fall and the crops didn't grow.
Everyone is hungry and they got no place to go.
There's war, quakes, and racial division.
Sit at home and watch it on your television.
When the clock strikes 12 and we hit 86,
it's a whole new year to get in your legs.
85 was okay, now it seems a little dated.
You want to make a change, but you just ain't motivated.
The first of the year is a very good time.
Just start a good habit, leave a bad one behind.
Don't make a resolution, keep it to yourself.
We don't want to know, it's your own mental health.
The holidays are here and you're gonna have fun
with your friends, family, and everyone.
Don't expect too much on the next holiday.
You will be alright. You will be okay.
Try not to overdo it in a party situation.
It's good to exercise a little bit of moderation.
I hope I see you out spreading holiday cheer.
Merry Christmas, everyone, and a Happy New Year.
It would be so cool. It would be outrageous.
Love ruled the world and peace was contagious.
See you later, folks, cause we gotta split.
Gotta do some shopping to get the Christmas tree lit.
The performance and with the performance of the building. At 9 in the morning, the first alarm goes out. Manager John Woodson coins are posted throughout the building, dangling red tape. head, saying facial burns, back injury, and so on. The injured in this drill, who the department must find and evacuate. In the lobby, Wood takes me to a corner where red lights burn on a panel of controls. When the alarm goes off, you'll notice on the panel the lights will indicate what floor the alarm has gone off on. What we'll do prior to the fire department arriving is notify all the building tenants that we are going to activate the alarm system, because there are people working here today. And then we have a person on the 11th floor that we will notify to actually activate the alarm as the fire trucks pull up. At 9:05, the trucks are spotted. clunks their burden down the hall to the stairwell.
Stricter and stricter demands.
demanding more and more systems for fighting the fire and evacuating the injured within the building itself.
Do you have any manpower available at that location?
Back on the ninth floor, forward command has just had an unpleasant surprise. John Wood and his crew have added some injured that don't appear on the fire department list. After the alarm went out, all the injured have been evacuated, obviously in excess of the 20-minute goal set by the department and something they'll have to work on. As for the elevators, communication system, pressurization, and standpipes within the building, John Wood says he's satisfied.
Hershey's turning out really well. We've been working for the last year getting basically ready for this drill, and we've brought in fire crews before and trained them on the panel, and the Spinard Fire Station specifically. And as we go along, if we found any bugs, we work them out. But today, it's worked great. The communications network, which is today the first time it's been really extensively used, has worked great. No problems at all. So we're very pleased with it. On a blustery Sunday morning in Midtown Anchorage,